Hi, my name's Dan Seaman.
And I'm Jeremy Austin.
And welcome to the Perseen Podcast,
where we talk to industry experts and explore topics of interest to internet service providers and network experts everywhere.
Hello, and welcome back to episode 7 of the Perseen Podcast. I'm Dan Seaman, Chief Product Officer for Perseen.
And I'm your co-host, Jeremy Austin, our Senior Product Manager. It's been a little bit since we did the last episode, Dan, and we're not really going to talk in great detail today about what we've been doing, but suffice it to say, we've been busy building product at Perseen. You know, this podcast isn't supposed to be just about Perseen, so we're not going to go into great detail, but we've been building some auto AP capacity management. We've got some really fun stuff with, plan assurance that's coming down the pike, allowing you to understand exactly how good of a service you can deliver, what kind of plan speeds you should be selling to your customers, which is often a tricky thing to really understand. Anything you want to say, Dan, about what we've been doing since episode 6?
I don't remember when episode 6 was, but a bunch of fiber stuff we're working on. And yeah, the plan assurance stuff is pretty exciting. Just being able to kind of answer that age-old question of what can you actually sell in a fixed wireless network is a tough problem, and we're taking a crack at it. So it's been pretty fun.
That's fantastic. Yeah. If we take things up a layer, you know, up from layer one, and we head on into kind of the transport and the application layers of the OSI model, there's really a lot of stuff that's of interest going on in the world of latency management. And today we're going to be talking about that, about some of the new, field trials that are being run, some of the new technology that we've covered briefly on the show in the past, particularly today. We're going to be talking about L4S. We talked about that briefly with Bjorn from Domos in a previous episode, and we're going to talk about that in greater detail today. And our guest today is Jason Livengood. He's the Vice President of Technology Policy, Product, and Standards at Comcast. Comcast, for those of you who may be international and not fully aware of what's been going on, is one of the largest ISPs in the United States. They cover tens of millions, probably at least 30 million subscribers. I couldn't get current numbers on that, but plenty of subscribers in the U.S., And he leads Comcast's efforts in developing and deploying new open standards, which is a really critical part when you have an ISP that has a lot of traction. To have them driving new standards is really cool. So Jason supports applied R&D via collaboration with the research community, engaging with governments, regulators, and other external key stakeholders on technology policy issues, and provides leadership on end user product technology roadmaps. Welcome, Jason.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So today I'm going to really hand this mostly over to Dan and Jason, because the nuances of traffic shaping are a little bit beyond my level of expertise. Dan has of course built the kind of traffic shaping that we use today in our inline appliances at Perseen, and Dan is definitely more abreast of the current state of technology. So Dan, let's go ahead and talk about what's going on with L4S and the Comcast trial that we're going to be talking about.
Yeah, so I probably we need a little bit of background here, I think, for people, and Jason's going to be the expert on this, on L4S more so than myself. But the goal, maybe you want to talk about the goals of L4S before we talk about how it's achieved?
Sure. The goals are really to dramatically improve on what I would call the working latency or network responsiveness of someone's internet connection. Because to use a really good example, during the initial COVID pandemic, everybody shifted to working from home. But even people that had, say, 1 gig fiber to the home connections still had, say, problems with Zoom or Google Meet. And the reason wasn't lack of bandwidth. It was a latency problem. And folks usually just pay attention to latency when there's nothing happening on the connection, just doing a ping test or something, idle latency. Mm-hmm. But once you start to actually use the connection, this other working latency comes into play. And so this is sort of the next frontier of performance improvement.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think it took us so long, Jason, even to just develop the term working latency?
I think because for so long, people, especially network engineers, saw increased capacity, which often gets described as speed, which, mm-hmm. drives some people crazy, that increased capacity was a way to improve end user quality. And it's always been good at that. It's all, that's often been a performance barrier. And it's been a really good proxy for quality of experience, or QoE. But at some point, you know, you have some diminishing returns. But you also have this rise of real-time applications, especially video conferencing and other things that, you know, are really placing new demands on the network at a bigger level of scale than before. So I think people finally started to dig in. But I think there was also a bigger philosophical challenge, because I think a lot of network engineers, especially those of us that have been active at the ITF for a long time, always thought there was this trade-off. You could either have very high throughput or very low latency, and you couldn't have both. And if you wanted something to do a little bit better, you had to give it priority over another packet. But that only meant that you had congestion, which meant that you had insufficient capacity. So it was always this either or. You had to have pick one or the other. And you know, eventually the community said, wait, we think you can have both.
But nobody had rigorously mathematically proven that it wasn't possible to have both.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. It's nice to have our suspicions proved wrong.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. This has been on the working latency for anybody that wants to play with this. A Cloudflare speed test. I think maybe Ookla now too. A few of them will actually give you the working latency in their speed tests. And that's a big change. Just even exposing customers to being able to see that that exists really helps point out the problem.
Yeah, I've seen that change happening in like the last calendar year. Like it's moving quickly. You know, Apple's tool has really helped that as well. And I can think of the buffer bloat people have been talking about this for a very long time and building some tools for that. Obviously, Dave Tott, you know, is very evangelical about this. But you kind of need a layman's term, and I think working latency is a really good one to really help people understand that. No, it's when there's this all of this multiplexing that's happening, and you've got modulating Wi-Fi, and you've got just a dynamically changing environment that in a sense that is far more important. That we fix the problems at those layers, then that we worry about whether it's a 500 meg or a 1 gig connection. Right. In Maslow's hierarchy of needs, we're now you know, we have sufficient baseband capacity, and now we need to actually make it do useful things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the interesting thing to mention there is that I think certainly folks in the network community are very comfortable talking about milliseconds of delay and wanting a very low number, but you know, when you speak to the layperson, they're like, what, a millisecond and low number is better than a high number? I thought high numbers are always better. And so Apple has taken a totally different tack, RPM. As you know. And yeah, the RPM round trips per minute, and with their network responsiveness tool on macOS and iOS. And it's an interesting difference. They're so consumer focused. So I suspect they're onto something there. But we'll have to see what happens.
Mm-hmm. So L4S is going at, I think, not just a minor increase or decrease in latency, but a very significant decrease. Can you talk just briefly about the orders of magnitude we're talking about here, and then we'll dig a little bit into what's changing to make that possible?
Sure, yeah. And just to level set everybody, you know, we love to talk in acronyms in the tech community.
Yeah.
L4S, low latency, low loss, scalable throughput. So yeah, it's a mouthful, but yeah, L4S. So it does indeed aim for a dramatically lower working latency. And so, you know, today, if you're using, well, let's say you're not using active queue management. And so in our network, that would be a DOCSIS 3.0 or DOCSIS 2.0 device, so fairly old. In other networks, they may not have AQM. You know, you could be talking about a working latency of hundreds of milliseconds to whole seconds. And keep in mind that that's just one round trip, basically, right? And if you're, you know, let's say you're in a mobile app or you're in a website loading an app, you're going to have lots of round trips, and those things stack up on top of each other. So that 300, 400, 500 millisecond delay could end up being 4 or 5 seconds of delay once you put all the round trips in.
Anybody trying to do like a ping on a 5G or LTE connection? When it's seen those like multi-second pings, right?
Exactly. So that's where you are without AQM. With AQM, which in our network would be a DOCSIS 3.1 modem, you know, you're usually going to get into the 25 to 250 milliseconds of delay, and that depends on sort of how far out you're going from the access network. But the objective here with L4S is sub 10 millisecond. And I don't know if that'll prove out. That's part of why we're having these trials. It's been a wonderful theory, and we've done some hackathons at the ITF that have demonstrated some really solid numbers, but you know what that looks like. You know, I think I would be happy with a 99th percentile working latency of like 25 milliseconds. That would be pretty amazing.
Fabulous. Yeah.
Right. But we'll see. This is where the rubber meets the road in the field trial.
Yeah.
I want to give a shout out to that. The report that Comcast produced, I don't know if you had a hand in it, on what you were doing with DOCSIS 3.1 and AQM.
That
was fantastic, by the way.
Thanks.
Yeah. I read it cover to cover.
Good.
Yeah. I was like, I'm so happy that at least one big provider really gets it.
Yeah. Well, and it was also this happy accident that we just had this natural experiment come up, because we had one device that was from two different companies, and one AQM worked on and one it didn't. So we're like, ooh, hey, wait, this is a great opportunity to collect some data and run an experiment.
My only sadness was that it's optional in right, 3.1.
Yeah. Yeah. Well.
Yeah. No, mandated everywhere.
I know. Yeah.
Cool. So maybe before we get into, I guess, get along with how L4S achieves this, maybe we should talk a little bit about where latency comes from, and specifically in relation to congestion control algorithms, because I think that's probably the part that, you know, you can't make light faster. So, mm-hmm. You know, L4S isn't doing any magic that's moving the bits any faster to the other end from that standpoint. So what is happening that creates latency, and what is the behavior difference that is keeping the latency lower in something like L4S?
Right. So I think what you have to sort of think in somewhat abstract terms about all the network flows that might be using someone's connection, right? In the past, when a lot of the TCP congestion control algorithms were developed, so like TCP Reno was in the 1990s sometime. I mean, that's like that's like, you know, feels like 1,000 years ago in internet terms. And then, you know, more recently, like TCP Cubic or data center TCP, you know, a lot of these things were developed, I mean, putting aside data center TCP, which was related to a specific, you know, closed environment, a lot of those old congestion control algorithms were developed in this era where, like, okay, you've got like one computer connected to your connection, and you're, you know, so limited number of flows, often just one. But once you're in this era of, like, in my house, you know, you've got dozens and dozens of IoT devices. You've got a couple of kids, one's probably watching, you know, streaming video, the other's playing a game, you know, et cetera. You've got all these different flows, but they're constantly changing how much bandwidth they're demanding. And the challenge has been finding sort of a flow controller that has a very tight control, sort of feedback loop, control loop, and can quickly adapt to changing conditions. And so if you were to think about ECN, you know, being used for L4S, you're having like two, signals or two ECN marks, you know, for every round trip. For others, you might have the older ones, you might have hundreds of round trips before you're getting that feedback to say, wait, congestion, I don't have that much bandwidth. And then they're going to do these dramatic backoff algorithms of like dramatically slow the capacity that is trying to consume before it goes back up, sort of that classic sawtooth pattern.
Yeah, the big TCP,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So part of the objective with L4S is to tighten those sawtooths so they're really tiny, that you've got this really fast, really tight control loop, and it's able to adapt to the constantly changing, you know, other traffic flows that might be out there.
And I guess the latency bit there is during those big sawtooths, queues build up in the network, and that's what adds latency. I think we've talked a bunch of times in the past that like propagation latency is not what we see. Like that it's right. Speed of light contributes very little. It's mostly buffering, and those TCP flows filling the buffers is a big, big part of that.
It is. Yeah. And in a way it's like the next iteration of moving, you know, reducing the normal end-to-end, you know, distance-based delay, mm-hmm. because you've had already content delivery networks, as an example, be created, move that content closer and closer to end users. And that's done a lot to improve QoE, but now it's sort of, you know, what's the next frontier beyond that?
Right. Mm-hmm. And from the perspective of wireless, dynamic capacity, a wireless channel is always changing in capacity. That's it's really right. The exact same problem as changing flows. It's just mm-hmm. in reverse, right? The inability to assess from inside the pipe exactly how much bandwidth is available to you And in the past, I thought that previously you know, we needed to have a holistic system, right? Like a controller-based system that had end-to-end knowledge. And there are systems that can manage flows by having, a software-defined network. When you have full end-to-end visibility and external visibility, there are things that you can do. But clearly, that's a very high-touch system. It doesn't scale, right? We need something that is able, from inside this black box of the pipe, to be able to really understand how much bandwidth is available to the flow.
That's right.
So if the congestion control behavior of the internet, which is primarily TCP today, Qwik implements, basically the same Rito style of congestion control.
PBR.
If that's the problem, why don't we just change that? Why do we need a new standard? Why can't we just update Windows, update Linux with this new, more aggressive congestion control deployed on the internet and be done?
Well, that's a good question. And I'm sure you'll get lots of opinions in the network community about the right path, especially at the IETF, where it's like, that would be like a cage match type of question.
Yeah.
I think number one, there's a huge embedded deployed base of TCP stacks, and it's no small thing to go out and change those things. And sometimes to see the benefit at scale, you've got to go do all of them before you start to see a benefit. One of the benefits of things like L4S is that you'll start to see an incremental benefit as you begin to deploy, and you're not sort of waiting for everyone to deploy it. You also are doing it sort of organically. You're not like, going in and changing everybody's Windows OS TCP behavior, and who knows what other effects that has have on other systems and so on.
But there's a kind of a fundamental reason too, that those congestion control algorithms cannot be deployed on the same pipe as Reno, right?
That's true. And I mean, ultimately, as you think about it, I think the network community kind of concluded that there are two fundamentally different types of flows. And instead of trying to jam them all into one type of congestion controller, that you have some traffic, in fact, a lot of traffic, maybe even most traffic, that is delay sensitive. And then you have other traffic where it's not, it's delay tolerant, and you want to build big queues that might be desirable. And that maybe the easiest way to solve that is just to have two separate queues, and then, let the application say, through its marking, hey, I want to be in this type of network queue with a really shallow buffer.
So if we
and
if we look
and
back
a different TCP, a different congestion control algorithm in that queue as well.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry. If we look back to the world of DSCP markings, where you could explicitly say, here's the type of traffic that this flow is. What happens in a world in which everyone marks their traffic as low latency? Are we back in the exact same position that we were before?
Well, I don't think so, but it's an interesting question. Folks like Stuart Cheshire at Apple will tell you he thinks that almost all traffic deserves to be or wants this low latency treatment. Because a significant amount of traffic is delay sensitive. And you may end up seeing that. I'm not sure by volume of traffic that may be the case. It might be more a lot of flows that are interactive flows, but they're lower bit rate, and some other ones that are delay tolerant are higher bit rate. And so it doesn't matter. But we'll see what happens. I mean, this is one of the really interesting questions that we're going to be exploring as we do trials.
That's an interesting thing, because I don't think we've ever tried, Dan, to deal with remove the flow classification part of fqcoddle, for example, and just do fair queuing without identifying traffic as interactive or bulk, because that's what there's essentially that bifurcation in fqcoddle today.
Yep. So would I be oversimplifying if I said L4S creates a kind of a, I don't want to say two-tier, because that is pejorative, a two-channel internet, one with a traditional congestion control, one with a more aggressive, lower latency congestion control, and then it's up to applications to opt into which channel they want to, channel's not the right word either, but you, sure. Like which channel they want to be in? Is that an approximate simplification?
It is, yeah. And I think one of the differences is, compared to prior approaches here, is that the application is expected to do the marking. Mm-hmm. And to say, you know, if you think about it, the app developer knows most what their application needs, and they know, you know, how that app is changing and releases, you know, over time and so on, whereas new features get developed and so on. And it's hard for the network to guess that. And if you think about, you know, you talked about the OSI stack, you know, as you move up that stack, there's a higher and higher pace of innovation and change. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of times when network operators deploy systems that are doing prioritization or trying to infer what type of application is being used and what, you know, the needs are, it's possible at one point in time they may get that right. But as soon as that's done, the applications are already multiple steps ahead because they're iterating at a different pace. And it's this impossible sort of arms race, and you know, it just doesn't make sense. So putting this in the hands of the app developers to take advantage of, basically saying, we have this capability in the network, we're exposing it to you, all you have to do is mark your packets in this way in the ECN header, is great. It also gets around some of the prior approaches where operators have tried to do these sort of network-based systems, whether they're DPI or others, to examine traffic, say, oh, that's a real-time flow, I want to give that higher priority, or I want to give that X or Y network resource. Because I'll tell you, you know, two things. One, that's a lot more difficult with the pervasive encryption that we have today compared to 15 years ago or 10 years ago. But number two, those systems will always get it wrong at some point and have a false positive, like always. Yeah. And for us as a big ISP, like us getting it wrong is like the Wall Street Journal reporter is calling up our comms person, and then the comms person calls me and says, what is going on? Like, this is terrible.
Yeah, because Congress introduces net neutrality legislation. when you get it wrong.
Cool. So,
I've got one more question about that dual queuing mechanism, Dan.
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
Essentially, given that it's difficult to distinguish a constraint in supply from a reduction in demand, how do you know how much of the quote available bandwidth should be allocated to each of the two super queues, these two parent queues?
Yeah, I'm not I'm not Bob Briscoe or Greg White that will tell you the math behind you know, figuring out like the square root of the capacity or something like this. And you know, they tell me that magic works, and I trust
them.
And
the trial will prove
that out. Yeah, but it does point out, like, it is important to point out two things which sometimes are hard for people to really grasp. Which is, number one, these two queues, number one, are at the same priority level. So they're both best effort, and they both share the same bandwidth. So it's not like one is getting more bandwidth and the other is getting less, or one is higher priority or lower priority. It's just they're sharing both of those.
Fairly shared across, essentially. Yes. DQ from each queue alternatingly, essentially.
Yeah. That's referred to as the coupled queues.
Exactly.
Which, if any of us, I don't know if we have time to dig into that, but it is really interesting reading. And I think that's kind of why I hesitated to use tier before. Like, even the channels, it's dividing traffic by congestion control behavior. It is not saying this traffic is more important than something else.
That's right.
Which is really, really, really key. So some very interesting things there for sure.
So it should provide a transparent mechanism for transitioning from this legacy, this classic world in which explicit congestion notification is not being signaled in this way, into a world in which theoretically all the traffic could move at some point and we would not experience any degradation.
And when we say that they're at the same amount of bandwidth, we're essentially saying if you buy a 500 meg plan, as a customer, you choose what percentage of that is new congestion control and what percentage is old congestion control. Like, not in the sense of like you type in the number, but in the sense of the applications that are active will go into one half or the other, but you still have your 500 meg.
Yeah, you still have your 500 megs either way, and the applications and those flows will just dynamically, you know, sort that out and share it. So at one point in time, you know, it might have a little bit more bandwidth according to its needs, or sometimes a little bit less. You know, that can vary, but ultimately that same total bandwidth is the limit across both those flows.
Yeah, very interesting. And how in your trial, and then I guess in the RFC, or maybe let's talk about the RFCs first. I'm not sure if there's a variation with what you guys are doing in the trial or not. What do applications have to do to say, hey, I'm using scalable congestion control, put me in this other queue?
Right. So it's fairly straightforward for app developers, at least from a marketing standpoint. On the server side, it may be slightly more difficult depending upon the level of control over over their infrastructure that they may have. So if they're using somebody else's cloud or CDN, you know, there may be some complications, and that varies by provider. But they first need a scalable congestion controller on the server side. And, you know, that's in some cases, depending upon who, you know, what vendors are in that stack, that could be just a checkbox in the config, or it could be more complicated. And then from a marking standpoint in the client application, they need to mark for using the ECN packet header, and they would mark ECT1 or CE. So ECT1 saying, you know, I am capable of this congestion control of L4S, and I want to be in that queue. CE is congestion experienced. So that's when it notices, oh, wait, there's congestion. I need to alter this flow a little bit. And it's that feedback loop that I talked about. Would do either one of those things. And I think the good news is for network operators, most network operators aren't really doing anything with the ECN header, unlike DSCP. And so in most cases, although I can tell you a story later, the ECN packet header should not be bleached or modified in any way, which makes it far quicker to implement from an app developer standpoint.
Mm-hmm. So is it sufficient to make these changes? Let's say that you're an organization where you don't actually care about whether or not you have functional low latency in the data center, for example, but you tag on egress, or is this something that really has to happen at the actual stack where the UDP or TCP packets are being generated?
Yeah.
Can this be done at a middle layer?
You optimally want it to happen at the application itself.
Almost have to, right? Because the congestion control algorithm is executing on the TCP stacks on both ends.
Yeah, I think you want it to happen in the end user's device, and in that, okay. You know, and so first, you know, you need to have some capability in the operating system, although, you know, you can generally do that, and then in the application itself.
Okay. I was just wondering if there's any use for a proxy in this environment, because, you know, you still would have the problem of your classic control algorithm in potentially a portion of the network that has a much lower RTT, and then have the new one in the portion of the network that has a long RTT.
I wouldn't think so. I think then you're getting back into this same situation of, you know, how do you tell? You'd have to tell that one application to always proxy just its traffic to the proxy, and then is the proxy just another middle box trying to make these poor guesses? I don't know.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Fair.
So application. So we need an OS stack. We should maybe talk about Qwik in a minute too, and other user space congestion. But we need a TCP stack that speaks new TCP congestion control. We need apps that set this ECT value. And then abstractly, before we get into your trial, does the next hop, like the home router, need to be changed to support L4S? Or I know there's mention in the standards that there's really, and generally this is often true, that there's one bottleneck in most, mm-hmm. you know, residential networks, or well, most internet networks. And there's really just that one bottleneck that needs to have the L4S support for this to work effectively. Abstractly, what else has to change beyond the end applications?
Sure. Well, yeah, I mean, it's a great point. You know, as you said, there's always a bottleneck on any end-to-end flow, right? And find out where that bottleneck is, and that's where you want two queues. Of course, you're going to have a different one upstream than you will downstream. The other important thing to keep in mind is that this can change over time, or from moment to moment, if you will. If let's use a practical example of someone at their home with, you know, maybe a few hundred megabits per second down and, you know, 50 megabits per second up or something like this. Their downstream bottleneck might be on a point of access network aggregation. So it could be on, in our network, a CMTS, you know, in a DOCSIS network. Or it could be in the Wi-Fi LAN in the downstream. In the upstream direction, it also could be in the Wi-Fi LAN, or it would be in the cable modem in that uplink into the access network. And so for the trials, we are focused on putting two queues in the CMTS and in the cable modem. We're also doing some experimentation in the Wi-Fi LAN, which I can speak to in a second, to test there. But you know, Wi-Fi is like, you know, 802.11, IEEE is like a different, you know, QoS and queuing land than the sort of regular internet, so to speak. So it has its complications. But yeah, it could be any of those two places. But these things are going to change over time. You know, as people have symmetric 5 gigabit per second or 10 gigabit per second connections, you know, you could be at a point of aggregation coming into a data center or at a peering point. Who knows? But the great part about L4S is that it benefits from this incremental deployment. So you can start fixing it at the places where it occurs most frequently. And so often when I have this debate or discussion with folks in our network team, I sort of say, hey, it's great to think about all of those other routers where you might want to have two queues, but like 99.9% of the time, it's in these two places. So let's go fix those two places right now.
Yeah. Right? Fix the pinch points. Yeah, and the rest of it will be, you know, that's very diminishing returns at the top of that CDF.
Right. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, exactly.
And then if the congestion is at a point that doesn't have the two queues, skimming the RFC, it seems like the guidance there is if the stack identifies that it's not no longer in a special latency treatment, it just falls back to Reno-based congestion control. So you kind of fall back to normal internet, I guess.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah,
that seems like an interesting kind of layer violation in a way to be able to understand how you're being handled.
If it's inferred at the endpoints, it's less egregious.
Very good. Let's take a quick break and we'll be right back. And we're back. We're going to talk about the Comcast trial itself here in the second half. I heard about this on Nanog, for example. Jason wrote a message to the list and said, "Hey guys, we're starting this trial with L4S," and it really you know piqued my interest because I was already following what Comcast was doing both with AQM and with L4S. So let's talk about this trial, Jason.
Sure. Where would you like to begin? Give you the top to bottom?
What the goals are, what network elements are changing in Comcast network to support it, which applications support it, what OSs support it, you know.
Yeah.
What are all the pieces for the trial?
Well, I'll start off by saying the relevant ITF RFCs are considered experimental, and it's a very early deployment. We're the first ISP to deploy and do field trials. And so where those standards are in the sort of development process, you know, you really expect that early experimenters are going to bring back a lot of results to the ITF because there may be a need to iterate those standards a little bit. And, you know, that'll be a way to sort of get more folks to understand it, to sort of build trust in it, get other people to do experiments and implementations. And so for that reason, and because in a lot of ways, this will, in the long term, benefit from network effects insofar as the value will increase exponentially with every new implementer. We're trying to be very transparent about what's happening in the trial and really out there, which is something I always like. So I'm glad to have that opportunity here. And so we announced trials a couple of weeks ago. We actually started provisioning modems this week. So just 2 days ago, our first modem came on the network live with low latency provisioned, and we'll have about 25 or so employees up by the end of the week. And then a couple weeks from now, we'll start adding customers. We had what I would say is overwhelming customer interest in this, which surprised me. We had hundreds of customers volunteer, which is really exceptional. Like many trials I've done in the past for whether it's DNSSEC validation or IPv6, like when you get a few dozen interested, you're like, hey, that's awesome, right? but we just had a huge number, which was great. Really demonstrates to me that people have a better understanding of what latency and delay and lag is than they did a few years ago. you know, maybe as a benefit of you know, working from home during the pandemic. But anyway, we're trialing those. We're using four different cable modems, two of which are our own gateways. We have these gateways called XBs, so XB8, XB7, and they have, it's a cable modem plus a gateway router function plus an access point all in one. We're also supporting two customer-owned and administered CoAM modems. It's an Aris and a Netgear device. And so that'll be a test of both the retail devices, but the sort of standalone cable modem where they would use their own router and access point. And then of our customers that are using the XB devices, most of them will be in gateway mode where they're using all of those functions in one device. We'll also test where people have it turned into what we would call bridge mode, where they've just used as a cable modem and then they use their own, you know, Wi-Fi LAN and router back in the network itself. So that's what we are planning to test. We have several weeks of sort of test scripts that we're giving those users. Every week we sort of give them an assignment. That way we're not sort of overwhelming them with 80 things that we want them to test. And the first week that we're in right now with this first phase of users is really just, hey, we turned this on. Tell us if anything doesn't seem right. Yeah, you know, right. This is the classic case of like, do no harm first, right?
Right.
So that's the first example. And we are running tons of diagnostics in the background on these modems and so on. And so that's sort of the first phase. And then subsequently, we're doing some FaceTime testing and any other video conferencing that may support it. But FaceTime's a partner with Apple. Then there'll be some gaming, so Valve and NVIDIA, and then there's some other game platforms that might support it. We've got a bunch of general web-based and command line-based latency under load tests that folks are going to be running, and we opened it up. I've posted on some research mailing lists and measurement mailing lists saying, hey, if you have any test boxes that you want us to deploy, let us know. So we've got University of Chicago, Nick Feenster and his colleagues there, they have these things called Net Microscope. So some of those are going to get deployed. We've got some Ripe Atlas measurement points getting deployed, maybe Sam Knows and whatever else. So we've opened that up to folks. So, you know, we're running a whole bunch of diagnostic tests. And then, you know, we'll see as we get into late August, more likely mid-September, to really assess all the data and the findings that we have. And then I'll do a readout at the ITF meeting in November to sort of present final results. But we'll probably have some go-to-market decision-making in the fall timeframe as well about, you know, when is it ready to deploy really? Do we need to make adjustments? Mm-hmm. And we may, you know, we'll see. This right. is one of those where I'm honestly not sure. Mm-hmm. Sometimes things are a little bit more fully baked. This is not one of those situations. So we're going to see what happens. And the good part is we've got some great application partners that I've mentioned where, you know, we're directly testing some of the stuff and sharing learnings. So that tends to really accelerate the learning.
They can probably feedback some telemetry from their side too.
For sure. Yeah. We can't see any of that app layer QoE. They can. Yeah. So yeah, right. We hope to hear some of that from them.
And then, so have they done special builds? Like is the FaceTime a special build that your test customers are opting in that is using L4S and like the game, I don't know which game it is.
Right. It depends on the platform. Like in Apple's case, you know, you might have to be in their developer program to get the version of the operating system that would have the capabilities. Or in other cases, they're rolling it out in a beta release and they can roll it out to a certain percentage of their population over time. Mm-hmm. So it can vary a little bit. For some of the games and others, it's just, you know, knowing how to go into the configuration and turn it on.
Okay,
which
cool.
is, you know, well beyond the average user. So you've got to give them like, okay, run these commands and go do it. You know?
Yeah, so there's clearly a lot of moving pieces in getting application support. And this is an impressive list, Jason, of all the folks you've got collaborating with this. The question I had about this is, how are you measuring so that you can define success? For example, usually in a trial, when we do a trial, we're doing a classic A/B, right? Let's make sure that we're changing one thing only. In this case, changing the queuing. So have as much, you know, use the exact same applications. What, you know, what's the data that you're collecting, or if you can say, right. you know, how are you collecting it? I'm the data guy at Preseam, so I'm really keen to know how are you going to define success. Obviously, we want to see that 99th percentile latency improve, so that should be easy. But how are you measuring that?
Right. So we've got a variety of ways. First, we have obviously a huge baseline of how things work today.
Right.
And in our gateway devices, our XB devices, we have basically a measurement client that's built into that. And customers might be exposed to this if they run our Xfinity app on their mobile phone and they want to run a performance test or do some troubleshooting. It'll actually do, say, a speed test against that device and some other diagnostics. And so we've run about 700,000 random tests, maybe 800,000 these days of those, plus whatever customers choose to run. So we've got a great baseline of, you know, what those look like to compare anything against. And then that same test for the XB devices that are in the test, we'll be able to run and see, you know, is there any change to those working latencies, to all the other aspects of health for those devices. And of course, we'll have qualitative feedback from the users, like are they noticing any problems or any issues? And then we will be asking them to run different tests, whether those are things like the Apple Network responsiveness test or other working latency tests, while generating load to see, you know, if they're really seeing these types of latencies. But ultimately, you know, we really depend on the application partners telling us some of those things. Some of those clients expose those numbers to the end users. Games typically do that. You'll see like a lag number in the corner or something like that, or you can see it in the menu. So it kind of depends a little bit on the application, but we'll be collecting, you know, that data from the testers as well. So I think those are the two primary ways.
So there's some, I guess, some of the applications are opting into the different queue, and then there's a lot of applications that won't. So you're kind of monitoring both to make sure you're not doing damage to the
traditional traffic
at the same time.
Right. And the worry there is that, you know, as folks would describe it, that you wouldn't want to starve the classic queues, right? So that's what we're keen to keep an eye out on. And that should be pretty apparent early on, but we'll see. But it's taken a lot to get ready on the network. And so there's some other Wi-Fi related testing that we are going to do as well. And, you know, Wi-Fi adds its own complication. And I think you mentioned that you had, you know, Bjorn on from Domos and probably talked a little bit about what they do. And, you know, they've got some stats and there are other similar products that can look at those types of performance metrics as well. That's sort of a hybrid of application and Wi-Fi, you know, to look at overall QoE. But anyway, so the first thing that we were getting ready for is certainly we have this notion of two queues in the cable modem and in the CMTS, right? But in the Wi-Fi domain, which is often the bottleneck. I mean,
the bottleneck,
people's Wi-Fi networks are a real mess sometimes. There's not really the same notion of two best efforts queues. And so in the Wi-Fi domain, there are actually four queues: background, best effort, video, and then voice. And they all have slightly different behaviors that are sort of programmed in. And so what we're trying to do with this traffic, at least for our gateways, where we can sort of translate the L4S marking into an 802.11, you know, queue mark, if you will, we're going to translate it initially into the ACVI for video queue, so that there's the separation between classic best efforts on Wi-Fi and video. Others have suggested that voice is the right one. We may experiment with that a little bit, especially for customers that have their own access points, and a lot of that is configurable. But we're going to see, and it may end up like just maybe it's just easier to keep everything in best effort in the Wi-Fi domain. Not really sure. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing we want to learn. And there's lots of opinions out there. I like to inform opinions with data and let that make the decision. So I think we're going to see what happens.
Well, and if I had to guess, there's probably a long tail in Wi-Fi chip as well.
Yeah, it's enough to give you a headache as you look at that Wi-Fi domain. But the other, the funny thing, you know, and I'm going to put air quotes around funny. You can't see air quotes as you're listening to the podcast, but funny from a network engineering standpoint, probably not funny from others' standpoint. As we were getting ready for this, we were looking at the marking, and we wanted to make sure in the Wi-Fi domain that we would have these two queues, the capability to use these two markings. And we realized that we were inadvertently leaking an internal only DSCP mark into the LAN and wireless LAN in some cases. And it was a CS1 mark that gets translated into the Wi-Fi domain as background traffic. So it meant that all of our downstream Wi-Fi traffic into our gateways was classified as background, and then the upstream would be best efforts. And it was really hard for us to figure out if that was really having an effect, because you're only using one queue down and one queue up. So maybe didn't matter that much, but we certainly thought it would certainly matter when you would start using two queues downstream and then upstream. So we wanted to fix it. And there were some folks that pointed it out on a sort of a forum that you know are really into looking at and running their own network gear. So was
Wi-Fi snippers.
Cool.
Yeah,
and that was cool to find out. But the other funny thing is it was such a sort of nuanced configuration error that folks didn't initially believe me that we're in charge of the config template, and until I did a packet capture at my house.
Yes. Yeah.
And it was like, well, you know, here's the mark in my house, like, you know. And it's been a lot of years since I've done super detailed network config management stuff, and I was like, don't make me audit your config before
PCAP.
Yeah,
right. So we often say PCAP or it didn't happen. Right?
Yeah, exactly. But the good thing is, like, with our virtual CMTS platform now, like, that stuff's easy to change. So it was just a matter of days once we found it, confirmed it, like, okay, we soak tested it. Okay, go push it out. It's done in 2 days.
So, like, across all of the tens of millions of Comcast customers, that's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very cool.
So, because we're kind of running out of our list of like technical questions that we've had.
Yeah.
Before we get to the end, I want to understand a little bit more. Let's kind of take it back to the top and talk about like what the potential impact of this, if this trial is successful, or even if you see like 50% of the results that you're aiming for. I'll give you an example. You know, we've been talking about how it's not just cable that's going to benefit from this technology. You know, we talk about that in the wireless world. Like, wireless just has the problems in a worse way, right? It's just more severe. But every system that has dynamic shared access, which is essentially the entire internet, has this problem. I was on a couple of fiber networks. I was doing some traveling late last year, I think, and I was on a fiber network. I won't say what state it was or what town it was, but it was a little rural fiber provider, and the home I was at had a very legacy fiber plan. So clearly this is the plans that the ISP was selling when the fiber was installed 20 years ago or whatever it was. It was like a 5 or 6 megabit plan. And now that provider sells gigabit plans, because why wouldn't you? You've got the infrastructure to do so. You're at the IXPs. It doesn't cost you any more to serve a gig plan as it does a 50 meg plan. And I discovered that there was 16 seconds of buffering on the 6 meg plan, because clearly they had to change their infrastructure to accommodate these big plans. And it made it completely unusable under load, right?
Yep.
Idle latency was just fine. But and in this case, I was like, please, to the person who was actually buying the plan, it says, please go, you know, upgrade to a newer plan. I'm sure they'll just grandfather you in at whatever price level it was. Just get off of that plan. And the fact is that even the ISP would really have been able to continue to serve that 6 meg plan appropriately with good queuing, right? It's entirely a queuing problem. There's no, you know, in that case, it's so low that it's not even a Wi-Fi problem.
Right.
So let's talk a little bit more about that, Jason. Like, what do you see as the potential impacts in terms of like real world human, you know, how are our behaviors going to change when we are really having with this expectation of low latency everywhere? Because already, I was just having this conversation yesterday with somebody where I was saying, you know, already the amount of value that's created by, say, unlicensed wireless in your home versus what you pay a cellular provider for terrible speeds and terrible latencies, because it's just baked into 5G. I've seen some of the recent reports from that. It's not getting better. you know, the low latency is clearly a function that this is something that we're interested in. I also want to ask you about the product side of this, but let's talk about this for a bit, Jason.
Yeah, I mean, this you know, triggers a whole bunch of thoughts, because this is a potentially a seismic shift in the way that we think about networks and network services and deploy them. And for years, we've always thought, just throw bandwidth at people and things get better. But with some people that might only have, you know, that 10 meg connection at home or 25, they could still have a really awesome internet experience if they had really low latency. And so, you know, that's one thing that often people, you know, it sort of breaks their thinking in a way. And to use an example, like I sometimes talk internally and a little bit externally about what I call the post-gigabit era, which touches on a little bit the declining, you know, marginal utility of speed or capacity. You know, like once you have a gig, does it, like, how much does it matter today if you're, then you get 5 or 10 or 20? Like, yeah. Oh my God.
Even if you're
really
watching 4K Netflix, they're 20 meg a piece.
And we were just at an IETF meeting and in March at peak busy time of the meeting, 1,000 people simultaneously connected. So 1,000 of the world's like smartest network engineers.
Heaviest users, yeah. Theoretically.
Yeah. 850 or 60 megabits per second downstream and like 650 upstream. So they weren't even using one gig symmetric, but you know, I digress. But so let's talk about some of the things that you mentioned. One is wireless. So a lot of the traffic today, even when you're, you know, quote, using your mobile phone and you might think, oh, I'm using my mobile network, you're actually using Wi-Fi. There's a ton of Wi-Fi offload. And I think this, I was just looking at the stat the other day, depending upon the mobile network operator or whether it's an MVNO, that offload volume is something like 70 to 80, maybe 90% of the volume is on Wi-Fi. And so that means that Wi-Fi is then connecting to a wired broadband connection like our connection. And so if we improve it, you know, you're saying for a given mobile provider, mobile user, 70% of their packets are getting better treatment, you know, better and more responsive network. That's a great thing, you know. So it can have a big impact there just because of the amount of offload that happens. Number two, you know, we're fortunate enough to have a lot of penetration in the broadband market in North America. And we have Sky in Europe and the UK, you know, with a lower percentage, but just in North America and the US, you know, if we can do this improvement, you're talking about an improvement for like half of the United States broadband users, right? So that is what's exciting to me. And it has always been exciting to me about working at Comcast, knowing that any improvements that we can find really impact a large number of people in the US. And so that's another thing. But I would also say, and Stuart Cheshire from Apple and others talk a little bit about the fact, and Stuart wrote a white paper years ago, I think you can find it on his personal website, about this, you know, like when he was just sort of starting in this community. But as you think about it, like application developers have always had as a core assumption that there is delay when they access something over the network, and usually high delay and highly variable delay. What if you took that core foundational assumption away and you said your delay is very low and it's very predictable in terms of that, you know, consistency, if you will. And what if that delay was like roughly what it was if something was on your LAN or on your local device? Like that could fundamentally change the kinds of things that app developers could do. And that was reinforced at the one hackathon that we did at the IETF, where we had somebody from one of the big application provider companies, which I won't name, but you know, they were sort of on the periphery of all of the testing that we were doing, and they saw the latency under load numbers, and they sort of did a double take and like, are you sure? And I'm like, oh wow, like there are things that like I could do app-wise that I can't do today, so I don't even bother trying. And so right. I think that what it will unlock, it's like a lot of other things on the network, like when you went from dial-up to broadband, like that extra capacity, developers are like, whoa, now we can do new things, right. And they try to use it. And I suspect this will be one of those types of capabilities that once it becomes available, app developers will, you know, really, you know, have some great ideas and then go make use of that. And there are probably some app edge cases that exist today, or excuse me, use cases that exist today, that have kind of borderline performance. These might be like AR and VR types of things.
Yeah. Apple's clearly working on that.
Things. Yeah, yeah, exactly. So, you know, those things are like, well, they're kind of like marginal today, but like, yeah, they'd really be awesome. And it makes me think, just to one digression, I remember reading a few months ago about Microsoft's HoloLens. They were doing some trials with the US military. And, you know, so you would imagine that the military has always, like, they're lavishing budget on this, right? And so whatever idealized field test environment they do, they probably have more than enough wireless bandwidth for these headsets, but soldiers were still getting motion sick. And I saw that, and I'm like, well, that's just a network latency problem. I'm gonna go fix that, right? Right.
Yeah, from a from a product perspective, because in your RFC, Jason, where you talked about the Comcast trial, or how to build a good trial. Great RFC, by the way.
Yeah. Not an RFC yet. Internet draft. It's on its way.
Draft.
Yeah.
You mentioned that low latency is something that an ISP should productize.
Right.
So in this discussion, I'm going to play devil's advocate for a minute. From everything that I can tell as a user of the internet and purveyor of low latency solutions at Preseem, where, I mean, you're giving us the exact reason that we exist, Jason, to say, yeah, like, we're actively making it better for
right.
a lot of people. It seems to me that the current behavior where we see this high end variable latency is not just a feature of the underlying network, you know, the queue buildup that we've talked about, but I would actually go ahead and call that a bug.
Right.
So in that world, should we just be fixing it and making it better for everybody? Or should we be creating this quote fast lane where you can pay, you know, and for a little bit more money, we won't add latency to your obviously most of the burden of this is on the application developers, but you still have to have the queuing mechanisms at the pinch points.
First off, I'm going to read my statement from my lawyer that says, this is not a fast lane. No, I'm just joking.
This is not the opinion, though.
Yeah. No, it's definitely not a fast lane because it's not more speed,
I was being deliberately.
Yes, yeah. I know. trying to get me fired. But yeah. No, just more seriously, it is an interesting question about how you productize it. And of course, I don't know. That's not my call to make. I suspect a lot of times in the past, the way that we have deployed things and other companies have deployed similar things is you want to start off with some degree of control and make it a little bit of an organic growth period so that you can watch and see what's happening as you grow into it, which might say maybe you only offer it to certain segments of users right. as part of something like a targeted product offer or certain tiers of service or something. And then as your base of experience grows and your confidence level grows, then it becomes more open to sort of everybody. Personally, I think that it's one of these things. I think it would be just a cool feature and benefit of the network to have, mm-hmm. you know, that it's got this. And over time, you know, other networks are going to deploy it and that will change the early deployers' behavior as well. So, you know, if we're one of the first to market, you know, and we deploy in a particular way and then, you know, a 5G network deploys it, you know, that'll have a cause and effect competitively. But I suspect if you looked back 10 years in the future, you know, at today, that you're going to have this as hope, you know, if it works, you know, as a feature of, you know, really any type of network connectivity.
Yeah, it's a migration path to a new type of, to getting rid of Reno.
Right.
So yeah, it longer term, it may just be all traffic in some magical far-off land.
It may. And, you know, the other thing to say is I think that there's a lot of times when people, it's certainly visually noticeable, like when you're doing a Zoom call, and I just use that as a shorthand for any video call, but, and you see, you know, audio and video get out of sync. But I think there's a lot of stuff where people have just gotten used to, like, oh, that's just how the internet works. Like, oh, I just had this hiccup for like a fraction of a second, and now it's okay. Well, I think that's just that's this latency problem, and that can go away. That doesn't mm-hmm. have to work that way. Mm-hmm. And Stuart's fond of saying that, so give him credit.
That's wonderful. A wonderful vision. You really do have to predict that future, because I think he's right. Is there anybody whose opinions, again, Jason, this is going to be data-driven, not opinion-driven, but is there anyone whose opinions you respect who really are not positive about this, you know, saying that, like, this is the not necessarily a dead end, but that it's not baked enough yet?
Sure. There certainly are. And you mentioned one of them, Dave Tatt, early on. And I've worked with Dave for a number of years. We've done a bunch of research grants to support Dave's work and get, you know, FQ-CODL and CODL and so on developed and deployed. So, you know, I'm a big fan of his thinking and work. But he's skeptical, and I remain open to, like, this trial might not work, and then we will go in a different direction. But I also have asked, you know, him and a number of other folks that are part of a group that was sort of pushing an alternative at the ITF, you know, tell me what tests you want our users to run. If you're a skeptic, right, we'll go have them run those things, you know. So we'll see. And I certainly anticipate there'll be bugs, tweaks that need to get made. And the sooner we find those, the better.
Yeah, that's the point of the trial. And it's really fantastic that you're able to, you know, get all of the ducks in a row, essentially, to make this happen. Because that, you know, when I remember when Dan looked at this initially, he's like, you have to change the way the whole internet works to make this work.
Yeah.
And I said, well, that might not be a bad thing. That might be okay.
Really hard. Yeah.
Yeah. Dan, do you have any last questions for Jason?
No. I think that it's really cool that in your environment, you're able to have so much enough control to pull this off. Like it'd be hard in, I think, other environments that maybe don't own as many CPEs and, you know, all those variables to pull off this kind of large scale test. I'm curious how this will play out in, well, like fixed wireless or DSL or fiber networks. So they have much more variation in CPEs and many more OLT vendors. So, you know, all that kind of, like, there's just a lot more things that would have to change from different vendors. So is it going to be something that can be adopted in that environment and anywhere the speed of cable? I don't know. I
don't know. I will say we certainly saw years ago this sort of thing coming where we wanted to have more control over the CPE stack and the access network gear. But you're seeing that in other networks as well, you know, in 5G networks with the notion of Open RAN and having, you know, the network operator be more of the systems integrator and developer and have more control there rather than it just be, oh, this totally vertically integrated stack from vendor X or Y. On the other hand, there's companies like Nokia, which have been a leader in this space. They've been demoing 5G with L4S for a little while. So, you know, there's a bunch out there, and it kind of depends what your access technology is and who your vendor partners are. But this seems like a perfect time to start asking them about it. And one of the reasons that we're going to be very, really public in sharing our data is, if the benefits are as good as we think they will be, this will be a natural motivator for those parties to go build this into their products.
Right. I don't want it to be a differentiator between ISPs. I really want everybody to do it.
It's about having a better internet.
Yeah, 100%.
I don't mind getting to market first.
For us,
but, you know,
yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you have any questions for us, Jason?
No, not at the moment. I think I'm good. Thank you for your time.
Yeah, thank you.
Oh, no, thank you. And how can people get a hold of you, Jason, you know, if they have questions about the trial, for example?
Yep. They can find me on Twitter or LinkedIn, or they can email me. So, you know, Twitter and LinkedIn is J Livingood, JLivingood. Or they can email me jason_livingood@comcast.com. And happy to find them.
Fantastic. Yeah, thank you so much for joining us. Just to wrap up, we, you know, of course, you can always get a hold of us, Jeremy and Dan, jeremy@preseem.com, dan@preseem.com, and on our website, preseem.com/podcast. And be sure to subscribe to us on Spotify or Apple to get regular updates. We'll hopefully keep churning out some episodes. This has been a fantastic conversation with Jason. Thank you so much for joining us, Jason.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Thank you. Bye, everyone.